The Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit is made possible in part by Samaritas, the state's largest private foster care and adoption agency. However, Samaritas also provides a number of other services around the state. They are one of the largest refugee resettlement agencies in Michigan. They serve homeless families, persons with disabilities, abused and trafficked women. They also provide market rate and affordable housing for seniors and HUD housing for families, and also have skilled nursing, memory care, and rehab communities in Grand Rapids, Cadillac, and Saginaw. Samaritas, we thank them for their support here at Deadline Detroit. This is the Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit. Thank you very much for being with me on this Tuesday. I really am glad that you are here and that you're giving this discussion an opportunity, because it may not sound like the most exciting topic, but it is something that impacts every single one of us here in Michigan, in any community that you live in. And the reason that I decided to take a deeper dive into things like municipal finance, school funding, roads, all this kind of stuff, is because we don't even agree on why there's a problem. And what I wanted to do was give people as much factual information as I could over the next few weeks as we go through all this kind of stuff and we go through the next budget process to understand why we are where we are. The impetus for this for me was watching people in my hometown of Grosse Pointe literally tear each other up on social media and in public over the potential of closing a couple of schools because of the budget constraints that the Grosse Pointe public school system finds itself in. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons for it. Declining enrollment is obviously going on, the aging population. But there are other factors that are at risk, that are at play here too. Are local governments getting their fair share of state money when it comes to things like education, when it comes to things like service delivery and the money that they are supposed to get under a revenue sharing agreement? So there are a number of different things that I want to look at, but this was the whole impetus for it. It was watching people argue and in many instances not have the factual information as to why things are the way they are, to get a better understanding of what we might need to do to fix it or address it, or whether or not these decisions are warranted or not warranted. I don't think that we're going to come to any kumbaya moments when it comes to these difficult decisions about service delivery and service cuts, unless we understand why we are in the place that we're in. And so I thought I would spend a little time talking about this. And I think it's important to put into perspective what is going on. Local communities have been squeezed. They have seen their budgets drastically cut. In the wake of the Great Recession, property tax values go down because property values went down so significantly. And while property values have recovered, property tax collections have not. They are capped under Proposal A at 5% or the rate of inflation, whichever is lower. So, okay, great. We hit the bottom and property values have come up. If you sell your house, great, you've got your property values back. And then the taxes pop up to what the current level is. But for anybody that's still staying in their home, which many people are, obviously, not selling their homes as much, well, those property taxes are not going to climb at the same rate of your property values. So those communities may have lost a bunch of money. They are not necessarily back to where they were before the Great Recession. And Michigan was already seeing property value declines before that because of Michigan's lone state recession that went on for as long as it did. So local units of government are not getting the money back that they used to. On top of that, according to a lawsuit that we're going to be discussing today, the state has been shortchanging local units of government on the amount of money that they are supposed to get through revenue sharing at the state. Now, just to give you a little historical perspective on this, and we'll talk more about this in this interview that I'm going to do in a minute, but keep this in mind. Back in 1978, there was a nationwide property tax revolt that was going on. Property taxes could be raised by local units of government for whatever they wanted to do. And they could just add these things to it and say, oh, new assessment, here's your new property tax, pay up. Well, people nationally were saying, this is out of control. We have to stop this. So in Michigan, we passed something called the Headley Amendment. This is something that voters went to the polls and voted for, which basically said, we're going to cap property taxes for you so that you can't do that anymore. And to help municipal governments survive that change, we're going to install a revenue sharing agreement that all these taxes that are collected on the state level, 41% of that is going to go back to the local units of government to spend as they need to meet services. And they also were trying to make sure that those revenues stayed in line based on the rate, basically on what was an inflationary level. So that, okay, we're going to cap the amount of taxes you can collect, but we'll also make sure that you're not going to fall too far below, and you can increase it a little bit based on what the inflationary rate is, but your revenues as a percentage of your budget are going to be about the same. Well, that doesn't necessarily take into account a lot of growth, and there's a couple of other things that don't necessarily work well on that, but for the most part, that's what Headley was designed to do. That rate got increased to 48 point something a little bit later on, back in 1988. It got increased to 48.7% is what it was. And that was in recognition for some new things that local governments were taking on that the state used to be responsible for. So the state was supposed to pay basically 49% of the revenue it takes in goes back to local units of government to provide services for their residents. Well, a lawsuit right now is charging that amount that the state has paid back is actually about 35%. And if you look at last year's numbers alone, they suggest that the state shortchanged local units of government about $2.5 billion. Now, that doesn't seem like a giant amount of money, but it is when you're talking about local governments that have been forced to lay off police and fire, consolidate departments. You have seen them cutting back on some services in a number of communities. You've seen school districts that have had to make some difficult choices about buildings and staff, not giving raises to teachers, pay cuts in many instances. The trickle-down effect of the state not paying its share in revenue sharing is something that has hurt a lot of different communities, whether they're rich or poor, whatever. Every community has been impacted by this. Now, if this lawsuit goes forward and they win, it is going to throw a massive, massive monkey wrench into the budget cycle here in Michigan. Legislators in Lansing are worried about what this is going to mean for their process. I guarantee you the folks in the treasurer's office are freaking out about it as well, because if going forward, even if they don't have to pay back any of the old money, a $2.5 billion hole, that's 10% of the budget. That is not simple to fix. But local governments would get the money that they are entitled to under the Headley Amendment if this lawsuit goes through. This is just step one, just to give people a little idea of what's happening to municipal finance and what this suit alleges here. I'm going to talk to the Michigan Municipal League later in the week to get their perspective on how they've been squeezed, what kinds of services cuts we're seeing, and what is their status today. Yeah, we got a booming economy, but it is not necessarily helping local government coffers meet the needs and the wishes of their citizens and provide the service level delivery that citizens expect. Again, this crosses all boundaries. Every community has faced significant challenges as a result of this. Some have weathered it better than others. But keep in mind, some have gone through emergency financial management because they couldn't keep their books straight. Well, how many of those communities may have been able to stave off an emergency manager or perhaps ride out their problems had the state been paying them what this suit alleges they should have been paying them all along? You look at some of the numbers. According to the Michigan Municipal League, Detroit has been shorted over $1 billion over the last couple of decades as a result of this. Think about that kind of money. That's not small. So getting a sense as to why your government is struggling, getting a sense as to why your communities had to make these difficult choices, I thought was an important part of this discussion. So I had a chance to sit down this morning with John Moak. He, of course, is a professor at Wayne State University. He's a professor in the law department there. But he also is the lawyer representing a group called Taxpayers for Michigan Constitutional Government. They brought suit against the state, suggesting that the state has been shortchanging communities on revenue sharing for 20 years. Here's my conversation with John Moak. Well, and your suit specifically says there are three main areas in which the state has been violating the Headley Amendment, according to your suit. One, Proposal A. Let's talk about that, because this is probably the really big part of this. You're suggesting that Proposal A and the way that they've been using the money that has come in from the sales tax amounts to a tax shift, which is something that the Headley Amendment specifically prohibits.
Well, the Headley Amendment basically states that the state must share 48.97% of all of its state revenue with local governments every year. And the Department of Technology Management and Budget is responsible for certifying that in fact is occurring, so they essentially do the math. Now, as it relates to Prop A, in 1994, there was a reform of local school financing. So prior to 1994 and Prop A being placed on the ballot and adopted by the people of Michigan, say in 1993, local governments were receiving 48.97% of all state revenue, and they were paying taxes to their local school districts to support the local schools. Statewide, that was $6 billion. So they local taxpayers were paying $6 billion to their local school district to support their local schools, and they were receiving 48.97% of all state revenue for their cities, towns, townships, counties, villages to perform services that upon which they relied in their daily life. Prop A basically eliminated the ability of local school districts to collect local school taxes, placed a state sales tax on the ballot, and the state collected the state sales tax from the local taxpayers. The state then paid the sales tax to the local school districts and used the amount of payment to reduce payments to their local cities, townships, and villages on the basis that if they could count that $6 billion as part of the 48.97% they were required to pay to the cities, townships, and villages, they could reduce state revenue that they would otherwise have to pay from other sources and keep it for their own state purposes. Now, the Headley Amendment provides that the state may not shift a tax burden to local governments. And the case maintains, the lawsuit maintains, that that accounting maneuver shifts a tax burden to local governments to raise taxes locally to support their cities and villages that now are not receiving state revenue.
So interestingly enough, I mean, what you used to sort of bolster your argument on this case are the words of Dick Headley himself. He suggested at the time proposed lay was passed that this was indeed a tax shift, that this would violate what the spirit of the amendment that he has his name behind.
Well, exactly. Dick Headley saw that should the state, and he expected the state, because the reason for his attempt to protect local governments is that the state would attempt to keep as much revenue as it could. Now that the Headley Amendment requires them to share a certain percentage of their revenue with cities and local governments, he expected the state to use Prop A to cut back on other support for local governments, as in fact they did.
Well, and all right, we'll get to the next one here because I think this is important. Charter schools were sort of something that wasn't foreseen when the Headley Amendment went through, and they have been utilizing, obviously, some of the per pupil grant that is raised by the sales tax under Proposal A goes to support charter schools and the students that go to those charter schools. Those dollars follow those kids to those charter schools. The state has been taking that money and counting that towards the money going to the municipalities as well. How have they been able to do that?
Well, they simply do it. I mean, the Department of Technology, Management, and Budget does the accounting, and then they do the reporting, and they're reporting that the payments to charter schools are payments to local governments, which we maintain they're not. And therefore, the $1.4 billion every year paid to charter schools statewide is being used to be included in the 48.97%, allowing again the state to keep revenue that otherwise would be sent to cities, village, townships, community colleges, and other local governments. Under the rules to construe a constitutional provision, the terms are to be interpreted as they were understood to be at the time that the provision was adopted. So the term local government is to be construed as it was understood to be in 1978. And local government 1978, we maintain, meant a local governmental entity, a political entity elected by the people from their geographic boundary and responsible to the people from a geographic boundary. Charter schools are private, nonprofit corporations with no geographic boundary whose boards are not elected by any of the voting members of the public in their general vicinity. We maintain they are not local governments, as that term was used in the Constitution.
Well, you know, you got an opinion back in 2004 from Mike Cox on this one, who was the Attorney General at the time, who basically agreed, made a ruling suggesting that these are not local units of government. They are not, quote unquote, political subdivisions of the state, which is what the Headley Amendment called for. How have they been able to get around that ruling from the Attorney General on that
point? They have not been able to get around it. There was an earlier opinion by Frank Kelly, Attorney General Frank Kelly, that said the same. And then Mike Cox, Frank Kelly, a Democrat, Mike Cox, a Republican, have both concluded that charter schools are not political subdivisions of the state, which which is a one definition of local governments, and they simply disregarded it.
Well, and that this is, of course, part of the basis of the lawsuit that's going on. Let's go through the third part of this, funded mandates. So things that the government suggests you have to do, or they don't suggest, they mandate that you do these things, like mental health care, for instance. If the state says that you must provide these, they cannot include those mandates in the funding formula, yet, or any money that goes towards them from the state in that funding formula.
Well, one of the other provisions in the Headley Amendment to protect local governments is just as you described it, that if the state requires a local government to perform some type of act, the state, the local government is not required to perform the state-mandated act unless the state puts up the money, unless the state provides the money to perform the act. There are some mandates that the state has imposed on local governments. The Headley Amendment required that the state report annually on how many mandates they have imposed on local governments, and the state has never done that. Basically, they violated the state act and amendment requiring the report. But we were able to determine that there are at least three mandates that are being required by the state, and we have been able to determine from looking at the spreadsheets from the Department of Management and Budget, how much is being paid to local governments to carry out those mandates. Those payments are also being included in the 48.97%. Now, what we say is in the lawsuit is that the amount to be included in the 48.97% are only payments in the form of aid to local governments. The payments to compensate for mandates are not in the form of aid to local governments. In other words, they're paying them on the one hand, but then they're counting it and taking it out of the money they're spending on local governments on the other.
Well, the bottom line of your argument here is that, again, you've got this mandate of 49% here, but in reality, it's actually only working out to about 35.5% that's actually being paid under the revenue sharing right now, as opposed to what it should be. And the amount you're talking about is about $2.5 billion last year.
That's correct. In other words, what we say is if all three claims are upheld by the court, Prop A, charter schools, and funded mandate claims, that they're actually only paying 35%, and that the differential last year would have been an additional $2.5 billion to be paid to local governments. And the local governments are feeling the squeeze, and they're moving in other directions to try to cut costs, to cut service, and to begin to impose special assessments and fees on the local residents.
Well, I'm going to be speaking with Eric Lufer at the Citizens Research Council over the next couple of days about some of those special assessments and different millage votes that are going on there that are funding things that typically would be paid for through revenue sharing dollars.
Exactly. And that's what's occurring. And hopefully the court will understand what the problem is.
Well, this case was brought back in January. At least the hearing in front of the appeals court, the case was brought a while ago, but the appeals court heard it in January. You were expecting a ruling within 30 days back then. They have yet to come back. We're getting close to budget season here. In fact, we're in the midst of budget negotiations right now. Are you expecting to hear something before we get to this date in September when this budget's got to be in place?
We've actually been expecting something on a daily basis, at least on a weekly basis. The case was filed in 2016. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there was a lot of motions, practice that took place between the attorney general and our legal team. Then a hearing was held in January, and the court, we were happy that the court very seriously considered the arguments on both sides and said, well, they had a lot to think about, the presiding judge, when they adjourned the hearing. And that they would attempt to render an opinion in 30 days. Well, of course, that's not occurred, and we're now almost 100 days plus into the time period. Now, my feeling has been that early on, after the 30-day period passed, that, well, that's to our advantage because we do have some tough issues that the court has to grapple with, and the amount of money involved is considerable. It would require the state reconfigure
every aspect of the budget.
Just about every aspect of the budget, yes. And so, you know, it is a big case. I'm sure that if whoever loses this, the Attorney General, or if we happen to lose on some parts of the case, we'll very seriously consider appealing. So to the Michigan Supreme Court.
What was the basis for the state's argument in suggesting that you were incorrect in your interpretation of Headley?
The basis of the state's argument is that a payment is a payment. That under Prop A, when the state makes a payment to local school districts, that is a payment to a local government. Local school district is a local government, but we said our argument, counter argument is yes, but payments that result in a tax shift, placing a tax burden on local governments under another section of Headley, are not permissible. And that that by counting the payment to school districts, it results in placing a tax burden on other local governments by cutting back on the money they receive. When they say a payment is a payment, they basically view charter schools as local governments. Or they say it's basically a functional equivalent, that a charter school is a functional equivalent of a local school district because they're providing public education to the same children who would go to public school districts, and therefore it should be counted.
Now, was any part of their argument based in the fact that this would indeed cause a complete a fair amount of chaos with the state budget? I mean, if you're talking about $2.5 billion, and you're not asking for back money, if they rule in your favor, you're not asking for something that goes back several years to when this began. You're just saying, going forward, this needs to be addressed. But were they arguing that this would be unduly harsh on the state?
The argument was short. The attorney who was speaking on behalf of the state basically said the state can't afford it.
Municipal governments can?
No, that's the point. The governments, local governments, have not been able to afford it. And it's time to correct the wrong. I mean, the state has been enjoying a free ride for 20 years.
Well, it certainly seems as if the trickle-down theory is in effect here, that the tough decisions trickle down to local units of government.
That's it. And that's what Headley was concerned about. Headley was concerned that the state, because local units of government are sub-instrumentalities of state government, and in the absence of the Headley Amendment protecting them, the state can do whatever it wants, which is what it's doing now. But the purpose for the Headley Amendment was to protect local governments because they are completely subordinate to the state legislature in how it wishes to distribute funding.
Well, John, I mean, you live and breathe this stuff, right? You've been working on this for a long time. When you talk to ordinary citizens about what's going on here and sort of shed light on this, what typically is the response that you get from people? Do they understand how municipal finance works, how this whole thing works? Or because most of the questions I get are like, how come we can't fix this? Why are we so different than other places?
Well, most of the people I've spoken to realize that the local units of government are being squeezed, and they realize that their services are either being reduced or other kinds of fees and assessments are being imposed. They don't understand the complexity of it all. And when I explain what this lawsuit is all about, and they understand that the state will have to make some major financial adjustment, they basically say, well, where will the state get the money? And my reaction to that is, well, let's start with what they've spent the extra money on to see, what surplus there could be out there that can be cut back. It's not clear to me how the state would make an adjustment, but it's clear to me that the law requires that they do just that.
Well, you know, I want to take this a little bit further. When you take a look at some of the unintended consequences, frankly, of Headley Amendment, Proposal A, things along these lines, I mean, you know, some of these things, Headley's been there since 1978. You have certain communities that do Headley override millage votes and things along those lines every once in a while. But, you know, passing any sort of a tax increase is never an easy thing in any community. And you look at Proposal A, which is now 25 years old. I believe it was 1994 that mm-hmm. passed. I was covering the state legislature back then when that debate happened. Are there better systems that we could do that maintain sort of the integrity of what was trying to be done with these things, but are they ready for an update?
Well, I think so, but an update is not going to be easy.
It's
I
a mean, constitutional
you,
amendment
you
here.
You got it. That's a problem, getting the legislature to agree to put a restructuring proposal on the ballot for the people. Or basically getting a petition circulated, which would have a great deal of complexity in terms of the changes that would have to be made.
Well, if you look at how this whole proposal came about in the first place, though, if I'm not mistaken, it was the legislature that sort of kickstarted the whole thing by basically repealing the old system before they had a new one in place. They had to come up with Proposal A.
That's exactly right. They abolished the tax and then they placed the Proposal A on the ballot, correct?
I mean, so would it take some sort of radical move like that on the part of legislators to actually sort of get people thinking about this because Proposal A was not an easy sell.
No, I agree. I do believe that would be the road that would have to be traveled.
What's behind your passion for doing this?
Well, my passion for doing it is that a number of local officials, I teach state and local government law at Wayne State University. I've had a number of local officials who have been my students, and about 2013, there was a conference by the Michigan Municipal League in which one of the mayors spoke to the shortfall, which they felt that was occurring as a result of the state not properly sharing revenue with local governments. And I said to a couple of my students who are now out working with local communities, well, what do you intend to do about this? And they said, well, we don't have time to do anything about it. We're so busy cutting budgets, trying to deal with how we're going to continue to work successfully. So I said, well, I've got some time. I'll take a look at it. And then came to the conclusion that the head of the amendment is being violated in several respects. And just thought that was entirely unfair.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you point out in, I was on your webpage taking a look at some of the issues that you raise. One of the arguments you say is that a lot of communities that have been pushed into emergency management, this was partially due to the fact that the state has been underfunding them. So the state says, you're not managing your budget, we're going to come in and take over, when in reality, they may have had the funding they needed to stave off emergency management.
Well, that's true. We don't know exactly, but we do know that those cities were cut back on the funding they received. Take Flint, take Pontiac, take the city of Detroit, I think Benton Harbor, they all receive reduced spending by the state. And what we see is that resulted from a violation of the Headley Amendment. We don't know if eventually, even if they receive full funding, they would have continued to have financial issues and distress. But it certainly moved them more quickly into that category.
Now, as I mentioned, you're not asking for retroactive payment of any of this money as part of this lawsuit. You're just saying that the state do it equitably going forward the way that they're supposed to. But would that open the door, if indeed the ruling is in your favor, would that open the door for municipalities to say, hey, we want some of that money that we were owed from way back when? I mean, they are strapped. We are seeing services cut to the bone in a number of communities. Would there be a way for them to use that ruling to go after the state for additional revenue?
Well, there wouldn't be a way. Well, I really can't answer that because this is not a class action, although the Headley Amendment provides that it shall be enforced by taxpayers. So it doesn't give standing to local municipalities themselves to raise the issue.
Understood. Yeah. But there is the potential of a can of worms being opened here, it seems.
It could possibly be, right.
Well, John Moak, we appreciate your time, sir. Thank you very much. We'll keep tabs on this and see what happens. This is, again, part of a much bigger conversation I'll be having. I'm going to be talking to Citizens Research Council, Michigan Municipal League, a number of other folks about what has been going on with local revenues. And again, the basis for this for me has just been watching this town go through a major struggle when it comes to school reconfiguration. I mean, there's big discussions about Proposal A that we need to have and how we are funding schools and education and everything else we do here in the state that I think is pretty important.
Well, the case could result in more funding for local schools and local school districts. But thanks, Craig, and for shining a light on this issue.
Well, I appreciate you welcoming me into your house. That's a big deal. Thanks.
The Craig Folley Show on Deadline Detroit is made possible in part by Mad Dog Professional Services. Mad Dog Professional Services focuses on putting their clients on the leading edge of technology, faster than thought possible, to capture new revenue streams. That's Mad Dog Professional Services.